Hey kids, the Superhuman Registration Podcast would like to hear from you. Head on over to superhumanregistrationpodcast.com and click the Contact Us link. There you can fill out a brief web form and submit a story idea for us to read on a future episode. All stories must be available to read on Marvel Unlimited. Otherwise, anything is fair game. You can also check out the current rankings by going to the same website, superhumanregistrationpodcast.com, and clicking on the list. Now, with that out of the way, let's get to the episode.
The world's not as simple as it used to be. It's not enough to be a good guy anymore. We have to be the best. The time has come. All will be accounted for. Or we will hunt them. Stand up. It's time to be the heroes we were always meant to be.
No, I was just going to say, I'm sorry that Steven and I are affecting you with our white boy rhythm.
I need to get on your guys' level.
No, you don't. That's what I'm saying. Run from it.
I have no rhythm. I tried dancing once. I hurt myself and two other people.
The one time the girlfriend and I went dancing, she punched me in the face.
Oh.
No means no, Steven.
Steven, have you gone swing dancing?
Yeah, it was West Coast Swing.
Oh, beautiful. I almost made a girl throw up doing that. I spun her around too much. I like a spin in the women.
All right, I think on that note we can just go ahead and start. Welcome everybody to the Superhuman Registration Podcast.
Woo.
We're very, very excited to be here on this spooky day.
Ooh.
A spooky day doesn't have quite the right ambiance. Nobody has a spooky day. Hey, how was your day? Oh, you know, it was spooky.
Maybe if you, like, lived in, you know, wherever spooky stuff, like if you lived where Buffy lives. I haven't seen enough episodes to make an in-reference that'll make fans go, ooh!
Maybe you lived in Salem.
There you go.
Down the street from Sabrina.
Yeah, they're bringing it back.
Oh my gosh.
You know, that new series is coming out, and I'm really excited, and that's all I have to say about that.
I have no opinion except for it can't be worse than Melissa Joan Hart, so good for them. And I like Sally Draper, so yeah, okay.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Steven, and this is the Superhuman Registration Podcast, where this week we are talking about some scary stories. John, Aldo, are you ready for this?
No.
Yeah.
I'm afraid.
No, I'm not, I guess.
Well, too bad, because we've only got about a two-hour slot to record this, so we need to get cracking.
Summon the Kraken.
Oh my gosh, Aldo, you're on one today. This is going to be a good episode that's going to take a lot of editing. All right, so first up on the docket, we are going to talk about the three-part story from the Frankenstein Monster series from 1973. This is The Frankenstein Monster versus Dracula, written by Gary Friedrich with pencils by John Buscema. Buscema? Buscema? Buscema?
I used to say Buscema, but I feel like that's Belushi? The most wrong.
Yes. I don't know what is the most correct, but I know that's the most wrong.
So this is an interesting read. We talked about Gary Friedrich a little bit when we talked about Ghost Rider a couple of weeks ago. He also penned this series for a while. I think it only ran for about 20 issues or so. This three-parter here in the middle starts with the Frankenstein monster stumbling across this band of, to use the inappropriate term, gypsies. And he winds up saving a member of this band from the advances of this super strong, deformed hunchback guy who he winds up killing. Then, sort of in gratitude, this older gypsy woman invites him to join the band, but she actually has her own secret motives. She promises to help him find his creator, or the last living descendant of Victor Frankenstein. In truth, though, she has no desire really to help him, but she leads him to this cave where there is a coffin. She claims it's the coffin of the last Frankenstein, but when he rips it open, there's a skeleton in there that has a stake in the chest, which she pulls the stake out, and boom, it's Dracula. And now Dracula's alive, and he's flying around the countryside and eating a bunch of people. Meanwhile, Frankenstein himself is feared and hated by a bunch of people, and so he winds up getting in a bunch of fights with first the Romani tribe, and then with the villagers, and winds up just killing a whole lot of people. And finally, he says, you know what, enough of this, I've had it. I've let you guys distract me too long. Dracula's out there doing a lot of damage. I'm going to go kill him. If you guys want to kill me, that's fine. You do it. And then he goes and he gets in a fight with Dracula. They have this huge knockdown, drag-out fight. And Dracula dies. And that's the end of the story. This was a weird story to read. I don't know what you guys thought about it. But I did not expect it to be quite so... Like, it felt like I was reading... like a Universal horrors monster movie in the vein of like the old Dracula and the old Frankenstein. Yeah.
This very much does not feel like a Marvel book in the normal sense. In the sense that there's no like heroes or giant like earth-shattering adventures. At least, especially when you look at like all the stuff that we have read, it very much doesn't feel like a whole lot of that. And I kind of appreciate it because it was a little refreshing. On that note, though, it totally feels like 70s Marvel, considering that we've started reading a bunch of that. It way feels like a 70s Marvel book.
Right. Definitely in terms of aesthetic, like, you've got the action on the panel and then the narration that's describing what's going on. But, yeah, as far as plot and story structure, though, this couldn't feel further from a Marvel comic.
I think that, like, the art feels Marvel, and I think that it's very of its age, but I think the art is still good. But, like, some strong poses, some dynamic shots and everything, but very dated. You know, and it's one of those where, like, you read it and you're like, this would not sound that great, like, spoken out loud, like, unless it was... Unless you buy into it, where it's like... You know, like you're watching Shakespeare and it's like, oh, they're going to talk like that the whole time, huh? Yeah? All right. Well, okay. But, yeah. I actually really love Shakespeare. I shouldn't say it like that. But, still. Now, this was...
Yeah.
I'm trying to see... Because I know that in the 70s, they kind of did... I know that, like, Christopher Lee was in some Dracula movies in the 70s. And there may have been other kind of, a renaissance of horror movies around then as well. Kind of in the same vein as the classic Universal monsters. Am I just making that up? Is it just a couple of Christopher Lee movies?
Well, I feel like there's always been this sort of cycle of monster movies. And I do feel like the 70s saw a bit of a revival. But I don't think it was just with the classic monsters. Although you definitely had, like, I believe there was a Dracula remake in there. There's a King Kong remake in there. I feel like the 70s, that's when you get things like The Blob and a lot of those other... Those might have been earlier in the decade as well, or maybe late 60s, you know, well before my time. But yeah, I do believe that there was sort of a monster movie renaissance in the 70s. But you know, I think the real rationale behind this series, I mean, it reminds me of a song that my cousin used to sing. It goes like this. This song is in the public domain. Because, you know, movies always use Amazing Grace because nobody has to pay any royalties for it. Frankenstein's monster is in the public domain.
And so is Dracula too, correct?
Yeah. And so is Dracula. So I think it's just, hey, here's an easy way for us to get some, like, a character with some name recognition on the magazine.
Wait, racks. Would people go with an established characters rather than trying to create original characters just for a quick buck? Have we seen anything like that in our day and age? Oh, wait.
Wait, say it ain't so.
I mean, you can ask the Robin Hood movie that's coming out this year.
Ooh, boy.
You know, I'll just call them up. I'll just go to walk over to my next door neighbor, the 20th Marvel film.
No, Aldo lives next door to They. Like, hey, They are coming out with this movie next year. Oh, guys, make something new. And cut your grass. It's making the neighborhood look bad.
So you say this comic looks like a Marvel comic from the 1970s.
Yeah.
I think there's a reason for that, and the reason would be Sal Buscema.
Yes. Yeah.
Because the man did, it looks like, quite a bit of work for Marvel. And it's a name, this is another one of those names, it's like, I've heard this name.
Oh, yeah.
I know this name, but I don't know his art style well enough to point it out.
I think I'm a little bit more familiar with his art style, but, like, I couldn't name, like, five issues or five series he's done.
Yeah, you keep saying Sal, it's John.
Oh, crap, they're brothers.
John Buscema.
I grabbed the wrong Buscema.
I'm sure that you guys already own this. If not, how dare you? You can find it for a dollar online. But how to Draw Comics the Marvel Way, published in 78 by Stan Lee and John Buscema. You get a how to draw in this style.
So one thing I want to say is actually I was really impressed with the art in this book. And to give context, we've read Spider-Man in 1960 from 1962. We weren't in 1962. And we read Ghost Rider up in 1972. So this comes like a year after Ghost Rider. And the art style in here is just, the art is cleaner and the colors are more vibrant and solid. There are some really great color choices and scenes and like just visuals in here. I kind of fell in love with that last issue. They play a lot with primary and secondary colors.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like you have Frankenstein who's kind of he's in purple. The night sky is green around him. He has like that red for his hair. And Dracula has these vibrant like reds and blues and like yellow backgrounds and punctuations in the scenes. Like, it's just really well done and really clean. I don't know if it's clean because maybe they cleaned it up for digital, but it looks fantastic.
Yeah, my experience poking around in Marvel Unlimited, they don't actually do a whole lot of cleaning up on these. They kind of just put it in as it is.
Oh, dope.
Yeah, maybe on some of the bigger titles, like their big event comics, yeah, and some of the more recent stuff, they clean up the artwork a little bit, but on a lot of this older stuff,
mm-hmm,
I don't get the impression that they do.
Yeah.
And I really, like, I enjoy the sort of climax of the story and the way that it pit these two monsters against each other. Mm-hmm. Which, again, that's kind of another interesting aspect of this. The Frankenstein monster himself is not really portrayed as terribly sympathetic. Like, he's not a complete horrible person, but, you know, he's walking around killing a bunch of people, and he feels bad about it, but he keeps doing it.
Yeah, still a monster.
I'm sorry, but not sorry enough to stop.
I can quit anytime I want to. Just stop harassing me. I will stop in my own good time, and now look what you made me do. It's kind of horrible.
It'd be a great intervention. Yeah. You have mummy, vampire, you have Frankenstein all sitting around. They all wrote letters to Frankenstein.
We're here because we care about you.
When you're rampaging against the village, you're actually only rampaging against your friends. I have a question about vampires.
Oh, vampires?
Yeah, due to a fear of vampires from, like, since I learned what they were, I know a lot about them as far as, like, how to, you know, kill them, how to avoid being killed. So I had to sleep with my covers over both shoulders until high school because I was convinced that would keep me safe from a Dracula bite. What I'm confused at is that the gypsy brings back Dracula by pulling the stake out of his skeleton. I thought it was one stake, one kill, that's it. You don't get to come back from that.
That's a Buffy rule. If I recall, it's been a long time since I've read Dracula, but the stake through the heart does not actually kill the vampire, it immobilizes it.
Ah.
And so in Dracula, I recall that there's this woman who gets infected with the vampire disease, and she's turning. And the only way to actually kill her, they put the stake through her heart, but then they have to cut off her head, stuff it full of wafers, stuff her mouth full of holy wafers, sew her mouth shut, and then either bury the head or submerge it in running water, and that's what kills her.
Decapitation and drowning combined with communion wafers.
And the mouth with the holy wafers, yeah.
Wow.
That seems like a whole headache. I think that Dracula really did the right, or Frankenstein did the right thing and just waited for morning.
and held up two sticks in front of him.
Yeah, hey, cross, man. That's another thing. I'm surprised Garlic didn't make it into the last confrontation here.
In the second issue, I believe, Dracula is kept out of some people's houses because they put garlic up
oh, crap,
in their windows.
That. Oh, no, cooking supplies.
No, it just doesn't seem fair that he can just come back from getting staked. I was not aware that you had to go through that. I did. Dracula Dead and Loving It is not a funny movie. It's not that great. Mel Brooks has done much better. But the scene when they do stake the girl is pretty hilarious because it's just buckets of blood. It just is like a geyser. It's ridiculous. So watch that scene on YouTube and save yourself the trouble and, you know, go watch Young Frankenstein instead of Dracula Dead and Loving It. There you go.
So actually, there's a couple things. I really like the way they portray Dracula here. And mm-hmm. in particular, there's two instances that I love. And they're both in the 9th issue. And the first one is on page 8, at the very bottom of the page, where the guy's like, take whatever coffin you want. And Dracula's like, you think I care? I'm gonna take it. And he just like stares at the guy. You just get a really close up of him going like, no. And it's just like for three panels where it's just like people's faces. It's really dramatic. And I feel like, because I'm a dumb millennial, that scene makes me laugh a little bit. But then the other scene I like is after Dracula's confrontation with his kind of ex-girlfriend, who tried to take his blood and ripped his vocal cords.
Oh, you mean Frankenstein's encounter?
Frankenstein's encounter with his ex-girlfriend.
Oh yeah, where she like barely nips his throat and somehow actually severs his vocal cords as a result.
Exactly, he has sensitive vocal cords, like he has a sensitive heart.
Oh.
And I like the part where Dracula's like, "What? You're not gonna backtalk me?" And he realizes that his vocal cords are shredded, so he's like, "You do not need your voice to die." And it's fantastic. Yeah. I love that.
It's pretty great.
Oh my gosh.
I've heard quite a bit about Marvel Comics Dracula. I've only read one story that has Marvel Dracula in it, and that would be Captain Britain and MI-13, which is the comic where Dracula has a base on the moon, where he tells Dr. Doom that he's too good for him, and then he makes a cannon that shoots vampires from the moon to Earth.
Whoa. Are you sure that wasn't Dr. McNinja? Because Dr. McNinja, he also has a base on the moon.
I have not read the Dr. McNinja story.
Oh, man, that's my favorite Dracula.
Can we get that up on the list?
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure it's on the list of the potential comics to read, because I really like Captain Britain and MI-13.
I know nothing about them, so I'd be down to read them.
I am entirely sold on moon cannon that shoots vampires.
I like this book a lot more than the Ghost Rider book that we read a couple weeks ago, I gotta say. Yes.
Yeah.
I feel like it is more consistent. Like, it knows what it wants to be. It doesn't really feel like a Marvel comic. It feels like a monster movie. Mm-hmm. And it's very good at that. It has some of the problems of the monster movies, especially of the early to mid 20th century, where it's a bit on the sexist side, and it's definitely not entirely sympathetic to the Romani population. Yeah.
We do start out with a woman going skinny dipping and getting pretty much sexually assaulted.
Yeah, she's getting peeped on by two different monsters. And then one of the monsters attacks her, and then the other monster, White Knights.
They put out a travel advisory in the Bucharest area that you're not supposed to skinny dip. Due to the large monster population, but not everybody reads those, you know.
I guess not.
And the real secret is there's a third monster, and it's us for reading this.
Oh! Nerds are the real monsters.
I was going to say, you talked about the colors. The coloring kind of bothers me, because the big, bold colors, I don't get a sense of depth or contrast very much, like you would, like, you know, Dracula. I'm looking at a panel here. Dracula's like hopping over a railing, and you know, there's a big crowd in the distance, and you can see the background of the village and everything, but like everything kind of seems very flat. Now, maybe that was a style choice, and it's still, everything's still well drawn. I just think that like a little bit of variation could help it to, you know, get a little bit of depth of field so we don't feel like everything's just right up in our faces. But that's a nitpick.
You know, I think it's fair, though. I think a lot of the book's strength comes from, like, close-up shots.
Yeah.
Which, ironically enough, are kind of the most dynamic parts of the book. A lot of the bigger, wider shots don't really work out all that well. Like you said, you don't really get a good sense of spacing or depth or dimension, right. Really. Like that part when the villagers are shooting Dracula with the crossbow. I can't really tell where they are in relation to each other. So I don't know if that archer is actually really good and he's shooting from like 500 feet away. Or he's actually just kind of terrible and he's like, you know, right next to him.
It flips because like in the fourth panel there, or the third panel, you know, crowd's on the left, crowd's on the right, Dracula's on the left. Same in the, you know, we have the close-up of the archer there with his crossbow on the right-hand side. And then we have a close-up of Dracula kind of from straight on, and it switches so the arrow's coming left to right. I don't know, maybe that was done on purpose, but it is kind of like, you know, we don't get a sense, like you said, of where everyone is in relation to each other. And I know that, like, switching from one, you know, one angle to the other can be done strategically, but I think in this case it's a little more confusing than, you know, useful in creating tension.
Yeah, in film there's a 180 rule, which means
yes.
that you really don't want to flip the camera more than
100. Yeah, like sporting events too, it's the same way. Like, you always shoot from one side of the court so that people aren't like, what in the heck's going on? You know, you watch a basketball game, it's always from one angle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting because typically close-up shots are typically the most static feeling stuff. And here they're very much not. Like, there's a lot of energy going into them. Especially on that last page when Dracula, like, decomposes. And I love that because he's decomposing and the camera zooms in closer every time. So you get, like, a better shot of him as he ages. And it just feels that... It feels like that movie Zoom In.
Yeah.
And it's really well done. And I don't know, like that one part that I like where he's like, you don't need your voice to die. Like, as great as that line is, the pose itself doesn't feel all that dynamic.
I love that pose. I think it's hilarious. And, okay, so I want to go back to the colors real fast, if I can make up a little bit for my snafu earlier of mixing up the Bushima brothers. The colors here are Glynis Wine, who we've seen before. She did the colors in Wolverine.
Ween. It's Ween. Is she married to Len Wein?
Used to be married to Len Wein. I believe they broke up. I think Glynis Wein's work here... She's credited as Glynis Wein on this book. I think her work here shows actually some of the same skills that she would later bring to bear in Wolverine. Because you remember in Wolverine, we had those very strong, very bright, dynamic colors. And we've got a lot of that going on here. The bright yellows, the bright reds, the rather abnormal looking skies. Here's a panel on the bottom of page 6 in issue 9 where Frankenstein is wandering through the town. And the sky is just green.
Yeah.
I think it's good.
Yeah.
And reading up again just briefly on John Buscema... one of the things that he was best known for at Marvel was doing a bunch of the sword and sorcery comics, the Conans, the Red Sonjas, things like that. And I feel like that's an aesthetic that actually transfers really well to the monster. You don't necessarily have the same architecture that you're drawing or the same nature scenes, although I don't know, some of these caves and forests here might translate from a Conan story pretty well. But I feel like that gives you the same, like a similar sense of tone, because there is a sort of bleakness, sort of savagery to those sword and sorcery comics that works really well when you're telling an all-out brawl between two other monsters.
It's funny that you say that because when DC Comics rebooted their universe in like 2011, the New 52, they had brought back Etrigan the Demon, or the Demon Etrigan. And it was very much like a sword and sorcery, but also monster clashing book. And now that you've mentioned this, I'm like, that's why it worked so well.
I thought for sure you were going to mention Frankenstein, Agent of Shade.
I would have, except it's not very good.
That's such a shame, because I love DC Comics Frankenstein.
You know, that was my hesitation, was I thought... like this was going to be similar in a sense.
Yeah, and it's really not.
No, it's really not. Because that DC's Frankenstein, I have to be clear on this, DC Frankenstein feels like a poor man's Hellboy. And help.
DC's Frankenstein is ridiculous. DC's Frankenstein has the Frankenstein monster running around carving up demons and aliens with the right hand of the Archangel Gabriel while he's reciting Paradise Lost and riding a horse. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, so, you know, Hellboy.
Yeah. Yeah, that all of that sounds very Hellboy-esque. Hellboy-ish.
The best stories I have ever read are all trying to be Hellboy knockoffs, so it's fine.
That's fair. I don't know what else I have to say. I think the first two issues in this three-parter are okay, but my goodness, I really just love that last issue. Issue 9 is a really solid issue,
mm-hmm.
and that's all I can say about that.
Yeah. This feels to me like it's trying very hard to be faithful to the character of Frankenstein's monster, but specifically, like, as the monster was presented in the Frankenstein novel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, it differs from a lot of other pop culture presentations.
Yeah.
Where the monster is really just this mindless brute. Here, he's got the reason of a man and the same anger and hatred that a man has, only he's, like, super strong and stuff. So, I don't know. I think it works in concept. I would be interested in reading an update of this.
Yeah.
Because I feel like this sort of story hasn't aged very well, but somebody with an appreciation for classic monsters but a mastery of contemporary comics craft could do some really fun things with this sort of story.
Yeah, I would like it. I really liked him. I really like kind of the tragic kind of character. It's a little obnoxious, especially when they're like, hey, you're gonna be our friend, and he's like, no, I'm not deserving of friendship and all this stuff. I get it, but, like, even this lady just saw her grandma, like, get staked right in front of her, and she's like, this is the worst thing I've seen in my life. He's like, excuse me, have you looked at me? It's like, excuse me, Frankenstein, it's not all about you.
I get it. We all like My Chemical Romance, but there's a time and a place, you know?
As he's walking to to Dracula's cave, and he's just singing, when I was a young boy, Father took me into the village. See, I'm marching
back. I like the Black Parade. I feel like I wasn't the right age for it, though, because I got into it late. And I wasn't an angsty junior high school kid, and I think that would have spoke to me, you know.
Yeah.
The best I got was a Silver Chair and freaking, I don't even know what else came out.
I don't know, man. 2006 was a really good time for angst.
You know, a lot of the best music really wishes it was Bohemian Rhapsody.
Some of the best albums wish they were Sgt. Pepper's.
A contemporary author that does horror that might do a good job of Frankenstein is Robert Kirkman. What? We're reading a Robert Kirkman story next? What's that?
What? And although said 2005 is a good year for teen angst.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, you know what Robert Kirkman did in 2005?
What about zombies?
We said 2006 was a good year for teenage angst.
2005 leads into it.
Yeah.
No, the segue is terrible. We got to do it again.
Oh, dang it.
This is good. This is as good as it's going to get.
Well, in that case, Aldo, why don't you take it away with Marvel Zombies?
Hey, so Marvel Zombies is a story about the Marvel Universe where there's zombies. That's the end. Goodbye.
Okay, I mean, he's not wrong.
It's a pretty self-explanatory title. I don't know what else you want me to tell you. So the basic story here is, it starts out with Magneto running through a post-apocalyptic New York City, and we find out he's getting chased by, I don't know what the word is, so I'm going to use flock, by a flock of zombies?
A cabal. I think you got to say cabal.
A flock of zombies. And I ran so far away. I'm going to eat your brains.
So he's getting chased by this flock of zombies, and he's trying to escape.
Hold on, give Steven a minute. Steven's really proud of that.
No, you're good. I'm quiet laughing. You can keep going.
And he manages to escape only shortly while he contacts P- people in outer space. I think they're on a spaceship or an asteroid. I'm not sure.
Oh, it's the acolytes from Asteroid M.
Sure. So he talks to them, but he also gets found out essentially by the zombies, and they go ahead and devour Magneto. And right as he's going to do that, or right as they finish, essentially, they finish eating Magneto up, the Silver Surfer arrives on Earth to tell them that Galactus is coming to devour them, or their planet, not them specifically. The zombies then decide, hey, we just ate what we think is the last human. Let's eat the first space alien. So they eat the Silver Surfer after engaging in battle with him and gain his cosmic powers.
It takes some doing.
Yeah, yeah, it does. He puts up quite a bit of a fight, which should be expected. He is the Silver Surfer, one of the most underrated Marvel characters in the public eye, I think.
Amen. Mm-hmm. I freaking love the Silver Surfer.
So, as they're doing this, we come to find out that Hank Pym has a secret lab where he's been secretly carving up bits of a still-living Black Panther. And I think he's doing some experiments. They don't really say what they are, but he's apparently also doing some experiments. I'm guessing that it's either to bring them back. Point is, Janet Van Dyne has followed him and has found out about this, so he's forced to decapitate and kill her. While this is happening, Galactus actually arrives on Earth, and the zombies try to eat him, can't, so they go into hiding. They develop a weapon. Well, they also develop a neat trick to keep themselves from going hungry. Because when they when they go hungry, they get stupid. Doesn't everybody though?
Yeah, I've been hangry before. Yep.
Yeah. So they develop like a thing where they like take a bit of themselves and eat it, and then like when they get hungry again, they just take that same bit out of their stomach and eat it again.
Oh, Aldo. It's actually grosser than that. They eat the flesh of, like, the Silver Surfer, but some of them have, because they're zombies, their, like, guts are all open and spilling out. So then they take the bit of the Silver Surfer that they ate previously out of their guts and stick it back in their mouth and eat it again.
Oh, was it of the Silver Surfer? I thought it was of
themselves. Yep. Because they taste disgusting. If they eat themselves, they're grossed out.
Oh, yeah, because that's disgusting. But the other thing is perfectly fine.
Yeah, so they develop a weapon that they... that they use to then kill Galactus, who's been getting who's been attacked by Marvel villain zombies, and after they devour him, T'Challa, who found the others, who were the people on Asteroid M?
The Acolytes.
He's bumped into them and they've gone up into outer space. They come back several years later, and Earth is green. It's flowing. There's no zombies in sight, so the zombies have presumably all died. But lo and behold, the zombies have not only absorbed the Silver Surfer's powers, but also Galactus' status, as they are now wandering through space, eating other planets.
I was skeptical about this series. The first issue... I was interested. I was like, "Ooh, cool." And then thought maybe they're going to come up with a cure and that's how this arc is going to end. And then they turn into all Galacti and they go around eating planets. And I was like, okay, I'm back on board again. This is crazy. So that was pretty fun.
Yeah. And I was telling Steven this, and I didn't want to get into it because I wanted to save it for the podcast. But I feel like... I'm sorry if I insult you, John.
Uh-huh.
I feel like there's two types of people that enjoy this book. I think one of them is like horror zombie fans. And I think the other half is like edgy teenagers who listen to My Chemical Romance.
Hey, man. You don't know what it's like to be me.
You haven't suffered like I've suffered.
Man. You've never been 14 before.
Because I read this book in like 2006 or 2007. When I was a bit of an edgy teen, and I remember loving this book, but now that I've gone back to read it, I don't like it. It's grim, it's disgusting, and I don't know that it's necessarily, and I don't know if this is just me being being a fanboy, but I don't feel like it's necessarily respectful to the characters.
Oh, you misunderstand. I think it's just, it's like so crazy it works. I wouldn't read it again. this is not going high on the list. There are good things about it, but the whole time I was like, ugh. Like,
yes, it's a very grotesque book. I'm not happy I read this before, like, dinner.
Yeah.
So, issue 3, page 6, where Wolverine goes up against the Silver Surfer, takes a swing at him with his claws.
Oh, yeah.
Wolverine's claws stick onto the Silver Surfer, but they don't go through him. But the claws go through the flesh of Wolverine's arm and just rip his arm bones right out of him.
Yeah.
No lie. No exaggeration. I had to stop reading the comic because I was about to throw up.
Yeah.
That actually happened. Like, I love horror. I really like getting scared. And there's a part of me that likes that sort of sick feeling you get in your gut when you're watching good horror. I'm a white guy who likes spicy food, where I will eat as much spicy food as I can get my hands on, but my nose is going to run like crazy and my eyes are going to water and I'm going to have a miserable time doing it. I'm the same way with horror.
Okay, well, don't lump in white guys who like spicy food with white guys who like horror. There's a difference. I am the former, not the latter.
What I'm saying, John, is there's actually no difference.
No, horror movie scares me. Habaneros make me happy.
So there's like a couple, there's one thing I do have to give this book. And it's like, so I remember, and I don't know what book it was, but I remember in a Marvel Zombies book I read, they actually showed the scene where Spider-Man eats his aunt and wife.
Ugh.
And it's not in this book, so I have to give it props for not including that terrible scene.
Yeah, seriously.
It's in something I read, and I don't know what it is, but I'm not going to go find it.
Yeah, that's top of my list to avoid.
Yeah. There's a couple things I do like about this. Like, I like when Black Panther meets the Acolytes. And,
oh, yeah.
And one of them fights him, so he just throws a zombie head at the dude. And the only thing that kept running through my mind was a quote from Jackie Chan Adventures. And it's that he's not handicapped, he's handicapable.
Yeah, I remember there was a time in my life where I thought nobody actually liked the Black Panther. This was before the movie came out. And since that time, I have realized, a lot of people liked Black Panther. I just didn't know anything about him because I was dumb and never read any Black Panther comics. Black Panther comes out really well in this book. He's about the only character who does.
Yeah.
He's missing an arm and a leg. He's on crutches, and he still holds his own in a fight. Yeah. He's great.
I also love, there's this kind of really funny joke. I don't want to say it's a joke. But it's a funny bit to me. When they take him up into outer space, and they're like, Hendrix, make him feel at home. And this lady, Hendrix, just like looks at him. She's like, I'd be happy to. One issue later, T'Challa comes back to Earth with a little baby. She certainly made him feel at home.
It's like, even missing an arm and a leg, T'Challa is the hottest guy around.
Yeah, to be fair, I mean, it's planet of zombies, asteroid full of, you know, six people. So his odds are good. But even still, I think he could still, you know, make it work if the odds weren't that much in his favor.
There were like four other guys on that station, including Forge, who, you know, Forge used to date Storm. He's not a nobody.
Yeah, he's got game.
Forge also just looks like Terry Crews with Jerry curls.
Hey, that's not a bad thing.
I know. I'm not, that's exactly what I'm saying, though.
Yeah, I've been binging Brooklyn Nine-Nine. That's not a bad thing at all. That's so good.
Terry loves his yogurt.
So I want to go back to a point that you made where it's like this book isn't really doing much to respect the characters, and it's not supposed to.
Right.
Like, Marvel Zombies is like a lot of the other zombie fiction that was coming out circa 2005. there was the big zombie craze, and kind of the point there was to poke fun at these different franchises. Like, this is around the time that Pride and Prejudice and Zombies came out. The idea was that they were introducing zombies to kind of highlight the goofiness and to exaggerate it even further.
And I also want to point out, since we're talking about the zombie craze, the not yet super popular book, The Walking Dead was coming out, had already been out for 2 years by the time this was out. So,
which is why Kirkman got the job.
Yeah.
Most likely.
Yeah.
There's actually, if you have the hardcover, there's actually a really neat opening where he talks about how he had been writing The Walking Dead, and he got the call from, I think it was the editor-in-chief at the time, or whatever that position is in Marvel, Ralph Macchio. Not the Karate Kid Ralph Macchio.
Oh.
Exactly.
Oh, he's the editor. He's actually credited on these books.
So he makes a joke about how he was super excited that he got called by the Karate Kid to write a Marvel Zombies book. but he was just really excited because he never thought he would work. As a zombie writer, he never thought he would really get to work on a Marvel property until they called him to do this. And he was just really excited. And I think that excitement shows off. I think the cast that we have here is probably Kirkman's personal favorite set of characters.
Well, we're also the A-listers at Marvel.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, you also have like Luke Cage running around.
This is around the time that the New Avengers got relaunched, where Bendis turned Luke Cage into an A-lister.
I also, one of the things I have to give props to, because we didn't really talk about who the creative team was. Obviously, we had Robert Kirkman, writer and creator of The Walking Dead and Invincible. We also have Arthur Saddam as the artist for this. And as much as I don't like the art because of how visceral and kind of grotesque it is, he does a really good job at being grotesque.
Yeah, I think
grotesque.
If this is your thing, then it's done really well. It just doesn't happen to be my thing.
Yeah.
The whole twist with Galactus was kind of like, oh, hey, okay, I didn't see that coming, because I kept thinking they were going to like try to look for a cure, but nope, they were just gung-ho, just wanted to eat more brains.
I'm going to have to actually you guys here.
Oh, jeez.
Sorry. The artist is Sean Phillips.
What?
Sean Phillips.
Oh, how did I get...
I don't know. How did I get Sal Buscema?
Arthur Saddam is the cover artist.
Oh, okay.
For at least the fifth one.
No, he's the cover artist on all of them.
He's all of them.
It's takes after classic Marvel covers.
Only zombified.
This particular one on the fifth one is a John Buscema cover. So it all connects. Oh. We're
actually, I have a friend who absolutely loves these things. His name is Kylie. He's actually, I used to work with him at the comic book store. Really good friend of mine. Really got me into comics. He's also really big into horror. So these books are like right up his camp. So much so that he actually has a statue of the fifth cover of Zombie Spider-Man with Zombie Mary Jane.
Because who wouldn't want to be woken up in the middle of the night screaming every night? Like, just, I had a cutout, I mean, still somewhere floating around, have a cutout of the Three Stooges that just was against my wall for like, I don't know, junior high and high school, and they lived somewhere in my apartment for college or whatever. And if it's your first time walking into a room and all Three Stooges are staring at you, you're like, oh, wait, that's just a cutout. If I had Mary Jane, Zombie Mary Jane, and Zombie Peter Parker looking at me every day, I would just wet myself every time I walked into the room. Like, just every single time. So, hats off to your buddy for not to probably, you know, overcoming that gap, that obstacle.
Yeesh. So I want to talk about this last issue a little bit.
Okay.
Because this last issue is where we start to get really good looks, not just at the zombified heroes, but also these zombified villains. And I just want to point out, page 4 cracks me up. Because you get, like, glimpses of zombie Sabretooth, zombie Juggernaut. There's zombie Dr. Doom, who looks like that guy from all of the Disturbed music videos.
Yeah, he does.
And then you've got zombie Venom, who just looks like Venom.
He's the same.
It's the same. It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who is that with the staff in the next page?
Oh, that's the Mole Man.
Okay.
Yeah. He's a Fantastic Four villain. Okay. Or he's Hans Molman from The Simpsons. I think about that every time because there's one where Homer, it's when Homer gets a perfect score in bowling and he's sad because he feels like he's peaked in life. So he's on top of a building getting ready to jump and he's like debating it and he's like, I think he's praying and the guy behind him waiting to jump just shoves him and goes, less chat, more splat. But anyway, on the way down, he grabs Otto who's bungee jumping. Luckily, there's a manhole cover, and they go all the way down to almost the center of the earth. They pass, like, the Chuds, and then they go, ooh, the Mole People, and it's Hans Moleman in an outfit that looks a lot like, you know, Mole Man here, and he's like, there's no escape from the Fortress of the Moles, and then the bungee snaps, and they go back up. Oh, except that. Homer decides life is worth living. Anyway.
So this book has so many gross-out moments in it. Some of them, I think, are actually pretty good. Like in this last issue, when Zombie Colonel America comes up against Zombie Red Skull, in the fight with Magneto, Colonel America's head gets chopped off, just like the top part of his head. So he spends the rest of the series with his brains hanging out. And Red Skull is like fighting him. Colonel America is wailing on him. Is just like, why do you keep doing this? And Red Skull says, you've never had such an obvious weakness before. And he just reaches up and he rips Colonel America's brains out the top of his head. Yeah, just like rips him out. And then he gets shot by Spider-Man and stomped on by Giant Man. And on his way out, he's like, worth it.
Yeah.
Hashtag worth it.
Hashtag YOLO.
Do it for the vine.
So there's that stuff that really works. And then there's the stuff with, like I said, that Wolverine scene that made me have to put the book down for a bit.
The other one that also kind of made me gag a little bit was when Banner, who ate Magneto's whole leg as the Hulk, has reverted back to being Banner.
Ugh.
And like you can see that the leg is starting to burst out, and I'm happy they don't actually show that like it did burst out and Thor has now grabbed the leg out of his stomach and is now eating it. Ugh. Because Luke Cage also can't handle that, even though he's a zombie. I kind of appreciate that Luke Cage can't handle any of this.
He's just over it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, there's one other moment that really, I think is just so awful. And it's in, actually, the second issue. Where Hank Pym goes back to his lab where he's got T'Challa tied up. And that whole sequence is just disgusting and horrifying. And then the Wasp shows up. And you get that thing that you always get when Hank Pym and the Wasp are in the same room, where Hank Pym slaps her around.
Ugh.
Only then, this time he follows it up by growing big and biting her in half. Or biting her head off. Ugh, I hate it. Oh my gosh, it's so gross.
Well, she was trying to steal his T'Challa charcuterie, so, you know.
I also think it's... And I hate this, because this is something that started to bother me a lot more, that I've kind of grown up a little bit. I don't know if that's the right thing. But, like, I really hate how all the heroes, all the male heroes are, like, super ragged and broken and super decomposed. But Janet Van Dyne still looks Janet Van Fine.
Yeah, neck down, you wouldn't know anything was wrong with her.
Mm-mm. And that kind of bothers me because I kind of wish she would also have some sort of, like, tatteredness or some decomposure or something.
I think the argument against that is nobody wants to see zombie boob, so.
I mean, at the same time though, who wants to see zombie anything else?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that that's necessarily any different.
Not me, I'm just saying, like, you know, if you had to pick, yeah.
I just think it'd be funny if she, like, well, not necessarily funny, it'd be a little disgusting, but I think it'd be in the spirit of the book, that's more accurate. If she had, like, a hole in her stomach or something because she ate something and then shrunk down by accident, that's a little disgusting, but, like...
Or at least, like, tattered, like, knees on her uniform.
At the very least.
A leg missing or visible bones. So other gross stuff that everybody else is dealing with. Captain America has got scalped, like, you know, down to his eyebrows. So you think that, like, she could have some battle damage.
Yeah.
So, not to get super, like, feminist here, because really, I don't think anybody is all that broken up about the lack of representation in Marvel Zombies, although I don't know, maybe there are, but I'm doing this quick flip through the book, and I've seen three female zombie superhero characters. There's the Wasp, Storm gets a couple of shots,
oh yeah,
and Moondragon, I think, is in some of these crowd shots, which is a weird choice, but like... And the thing is, they all look like they're non-zombie selves, except they've got, teeth problems.
Yeah.
Ugh, those teeth are horrifying to me.
I have a lot of problems with, like, female character designs nowadays. And, like, I mean, it's not just Marvel. Like, it's also, like, everything else. Because men always have, like, these really cool, interesting-looking costumes. And the women just always have, like, leather, like, skin-tight suits. And, like, it kind of bugs me a little bit more here, because I want them to look just as tattered as the dudes. Like, is that so much to ask for?
Yeah, equality. It means that everybody gets their, you know, rib cages cut up and losing limbs and whatever.
However, I do appreciate that the only, like, zombie... That Janet Van Dyne does come out of it okay. And she even comes out of it with a robot body with boobs, because, you know, she's a woman.
How else would they know that she's female?
Anyways, like that's my feminist rant for the day. other than that, I mean, that's obviously not the biggest issue I've had with this book.
No. I gotta say, I don't really love this book, even though I like horror stuff. This is just like gross out body horror, which I'm not the biggest fan of.
I think that's what makes me angry, is that it's just like gross out stuff, and I hate gross out stuff.
Yeah, that's my least favorite kind of horror. But at the same time, I gotta give it up for the covers on this. We talked about the covers a little bit.
Yeah.
First, I gotta say, the logos are really good. I like the Marvel Zombies logo. Like, it's the lettering on the word zombies with the O that just kind of spirals in on itself. I really like it. I think it's good stuff. And then these covers themselves, as much as they're just kind of like gross out, there are a lot of neat little details, like the cover to issue 3 is it's an homage to a famous cover where Wolverine's got his claws extended and the Hulk's reflection can be seen in his claws. And both Wolverine and the Hulk, their mouths are full of eyeballs. Ugh. Like, it's disgusting, but it's also clever.
I just noticed that in issue 2, I was looking at Iron Man because I thought Iron Man armor over a skeleton looked kind of cool. But then I saw look at Captain America's head.
Oh, what is that?
He's got a bird's nest in his head.
There's baby birds chirping for their, their regurgitated food from their mother.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Yeah.
And again, kind of clever. Any final thoughts on Marvel Zombies?
I mean, now I know. It's one of those, like, now I know that I'm better for having read it, just so I know not to continue down this path.
It's, it's one of those things where personally I know I don't like it, but having a friend that does, that loves this book, I'm also able to see why people like it, even though I myself wanted to put it down every other issue.
That's a good point, because it's well done, as far as, like, the art and writing, I think, works for what it is. I just am not... It's not for me.
Yeah.
But at least it's not, like, poorly drawn and poorly written or whatever. That's not the problem. It's the subject matter of, like, ugh, he's eating T'Challa a piece at a time. Like, ugh.
Yeah, like, for me, honestly, like, my favorite parts of this book are honestly, like, the slapsticky stuff. Which...
Yes.
Probably should, like Captain America getting, like, half his head diced off. Like, that's a little funny.
Spider-Man kind of falling apart.
Oh, yeah. he's limping around with his leg, and he's like, hey, guys, can you help me out here?
No, I think my favorite bit is when the guys who ate Magneto show up and Iron Man confronts them, and Iron Man's like, did you eat somebody? And they're like, no, we didn't eat anybody. And he's like, Spider-Man, tell me about your wife. Oh, I ate her. You only get emotional when you're full. Like, that was really funny.
And my other favorite joke, or not joke, my other favorite tidbit is, T'Challa coming back to Earth with a baby a few years later.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Like, we were quite comfortable up on the asteroid. Ooh, maybe it was the satellite of love. No, that's from Mystery Science Theater, sorry. Ugh, let's put these monstrosities on the list.
Yeah, I think we are ready to rank.
I think I'm putting them... my vote is after Happily Ever After for both of them.
Oh, wow. Okay, so let's orient people real fast so that we know where we're all at. We currently have 28 stories on our list, so these two are going to be number 29 and number 30. So right now, number 1, Ms. Marvel, No Normal, the origin story from the 2014 series launch. Number 28 is Spider-Man One More Day, a story that is a real bad. And so you're wanting to put them both below number 25, so that's really low on our list.
Because here's the thing, I didn't mind 25. It was just a nothing kind of meh story, like just kind of a day in the life of Avengers and kind of meh. These were like hard to read in parts, like the broken up panels. Again, well told and you know, it works for the genre, but like they eat Galactus and there's a separate panel like showing the gore and everyone just getting like digging into him. No thank you.
So we're breaking convention a little bit by ranking Marvel Zombies first. Since we're talking about Marvel Zombies, though, like, I actually think I agree. Like, I don't hate it like I hated Ultimate Wolverine versus Hulk. But I would rather read the New Avengers annual with Luke Cage and Jessica Jones. I'd rather read that one issue than Marvel Zombies. So I would be very happy putting this in at number 6. Or 26.
My problem with this is I'd rather read this over Spider-Man versus Netman and Rotten. But I would also prefer to read Civil War over this. So I think I'm putting this a little higher than both of you. So I'm willing to concede to whatever ranking you guys put Marvel Zombies at.
I'm still surprised that Spider-Man versus Netman and Rotten and Ride the Pain Train are above Civil War. That just tells you how good of an arguer that Steven... A debater, excuse me. Steven is.
Yeah. So, for me, the thing that justifies putting Spidey-Man versus Natman and Rotten so comparatively high is that it's got a lot of comedic craft behind it. And I'm not sure that I would want to make the same argument for the craft on display in Marvel Zombies.
Yeah,
somebody else can do that if they want to. I that's not going to be me.
Nope.
So, is that the power of democracy at work again? Are we putting this at number 26?
Yeah, I guess we are.
Yes, please.
Okay. But to go back to the Monster of Frankenstein book, I would actually want to put this one personally a little bit higher. Before the show, before John got on the call, Aldo and I were talking. I actually like this better than the Ghost Rider story that we read.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I wouldn't like care to really read it again, but I think anything below Civil War is one that I'm okay not really reading again.
Even if it wasn't bad.
Yeah, like even if it wasn't bad. Like Happily Ever After, that issue of New Avengers we read, that wasn't bad.
No.
It just wasn't like knock your socks off. Like, ooh, it didn't really, there's not much to reread.
I'd have to agree. Fiend and the Fury, I liked it. I actually like it more than The Search for Eternity. But that's a little too high up.
Yeah, I think the one thing that, again, I'm going to justify the placement for The Search for Eternity a little bit, is that's got really good art.
Yeah.
I do like that Steve Ditko art. I like the crazy Doctor Strange scenes. I like the crazy design for Eternity. I don't think the Frankenstein Monster versus Dracula story has anything that's quite that good. Or quite that iconic. I'll say it that way.
That's fair to say. Because it is some solid... There's some great dramatic poses. You know, just dynamic action, I think. But yeah, it's not quite on the same... It's not as out there, you know. The Search for Eternity, that was doing something, you know, outside the norm. This is very much the norm. Done well, but not anything surprising. Like, of course there's going to be a panel of Dracula going, to die!
Yeah. Okay, so that enters our list then at number 23, which, if I'm not mistaken, already knocks Marvel Zombies down to number 27.
Good.
All right, and that's it for the rankings for this week. So
I still feel a little bad about Marvel Zombies because I know there are people that love that book, but I just I just can't.
And that's okay. Like, this list is totally,
it's
you
us.
Know, subjective. This is our opinions, and it's not even really a true reflection of our opinions because we don't agree on where things get ranked, and so frequently things get ranked and nobody's happy.
This is a this is a compromise.
So who are we making this list for?
What, people who don't know as much, people who are wrong about
comics. To give people hope that the democratic system still works.
Oh man.
Oh. Jeez, Aldo. I mean
that said, you know, we've actually had consensus for the last couple of weeks. So that's something.
Now I feel bad. Now I feel like I killed it.
Great, Aldo, you killed democracy.
I was just thinking about current events and it made me sad.
Well, we got no time to be sad here. We have to talk about the next episode. So today, this episode that we are recording now that you are listening to will be going up on the 29th of October, so you can listen to it and get in a proper disgusting mood for Halloween.
Ooh.
But we don't want to just leave you there because there's another really important day that's coming up after that, and that is Election Day. So anyway, our next episode is going to go up on November 12th, which is actually Veterans Day, and it's, or at least Veterans Day observed. And in between now and that episode going up will be Election Day here in the United States. And so we wanted to pull out something, some Marvel comic that would help us to celebrate the history a little bit of the United States. And so we're doing that by reading a series by a British author.
That's a bit of a stretch.
Oh, it's such a stretch. I don't even care.
Are you sure this isn't a Fantastic Four book because of how much you're stretching this, Mr. Fantastic?
Yeah, we're going to read 1602 by Neil Gaiman. Now, it's actually listed as 1602. This is the 2003-2004 miniseries written by Neil Gaiman. Reimagines all the Marvel Comics characters in, like, colonial times on or around the year 1602.
I'm guessing there's going to be a Scarlet Witch burning.
Ooh.
I have not read this before.
I have, but it's been a long time. I don't remember it at all.
I've read, like, an issue out of this book.
Additionally, though, we are going to read another event comic, this one predating Civil War, but just barely. We are going to read House of M, another 2005 miniseries. Man, 2005 was quite the year for comics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know about you guys, 2005 is actually around the time that I started reading comics. So a lot of these stories that we are talking about in recent weeks, your 1602s, your Marvel Zombies, your New Avengers, like, these were comics that were at the forefront when I started reading comics. So all of these feel like they're very big, very important stories, even though I'm not sure that they necessarily all hold up.
You know, it's actually funny because 2005 is kind of like, we only have one book that we've read from 2005, but we do have stuff from like 2003 and a few from 06 and 07. But actually, most of our books are from 2012 up until 2016.
True. And I don't know, I'm going to, a lot of those books, I feel like, are building on or have built on the status quo that was established and was continuing to be built upon around the time of Civil War, which was in 2006.
And I'm just saying that because I was, when I was looking at Marvel 1602, I was thinking about the year it came out, which I think was that also 2005? Or
it was 2003, so it predates it a little bit.
Yeah, I was thinking about how it felt like we were reading a lot of books from that time, and then when I went in to look at the list, it's like, oh no, it's actually not. It feels like we've read a lot from there, but I think that's just us personally have read a lot from there.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And you know what we need to do? You know what we need on our list?
What?
We need some 90s comics.
Oh, yeah. We have, none.
We have... Infinity Gauntlet is technically a 90s comic. It came out in 91.
Which is crazy, because, that's when I was, introduced to comics and really liked comics. And a lot of the comics that I really liked or thought I liked are ones that people, hate now. Like, Heroes Reborn and stuff. And, the Onslaught... story arc with the X-Men or whatever. At the time, I was like, whoa, this is the biggest bad guy ever. Holy crap. And now it's just like, meh.
And so. If you're curious about the list that we keep mentioning, you can go to the list at superhumanregistrationpodcast.com/the list.
Woo-hoo! And while you're there, you might as well click on that Contact Us link, and that way you can submit stories for us to review in a future episode of the show.
So get a shout-out and get a little love and feel that you're contributing to this democratic process of compromise and bad comics. I don't know. You could troll us. You could put a bunch of really horrible comics on there. Has Eminem ever been in any other comics?
I hope not.
Don't boo. Vote.
Yeah.
Well, guys, we actually have wrapped up a little bit early. I think we've got a bit of time to talk about some back matter if you want to.
I will say that Marvel's Daredevil on Netflix, Season 3, has been very good. I'm not finished yet. I did not enjoy Luke Cage. I watched all of the first season. Really didn't like Iron Fist. I gave up, I think, 8 episodes in, maybe less.
Well, I have good news for you then.
Yeah, they're gone. Yeah. I think Luke Cage was just fine when he was kind of guest starring in Jessica Jones, how he was introduced. That was cool.
Mm-hmm. And I like the first half of Luke Cage.
First couple episodes, I was like, okay, this could be cool. And I want it to be good, but it just wasn't. And Iron Fist, I had just read the Ed Brubaker and Matt Fraction run, and it was so good. And then the show was just not. So anyhow, people say that the second seasons were an improvement, but I just... fool me once, I'm not going to waste my time. But Daredevil Season 2 was pretty good. I liked the first half of the season with Punisher more than I liked the last half with Elektra. But it still was overall pretty good. Daredevil Season 3 so far has been incredible. As good as Season 1, and I'm really enjoying it. So, yeah.
What's the story it's tackling in Season 3?
So... Matt, I guess at the end of Defenders, a building fell on him in Elektra, and everyone thought he was dead, but he survived. And so he's been hurt really bad. He's lost hearing in one of his ears, so he's got to get back up to fighting strength. The Kingpin cuts a deal with the FBI where he's informing on other crime groups and kind of taking out his competition.
Oh.
And while that's going on, Karen Page is a reporter. She's trying to take down the Kingpin because all of Hell's Kitchen is mad that he's because of his deal with the FBI, he's got this house arrest where he's in a penthouse at this hotel. And he's slowly but surely getting all of his stuff back. So he's living in style. It just happens to be house arrest, but he's able to work around it and get things going. And I won't say anything except for it introduces Bullseye.
Oh.
And Bullseye is really great. The way they introduce him, the way they flesh out the character is really great. And I'm so excited to see where they go with it. Because, I'm only 8 episodes in or 9 and there's 13.
Do you...
So...
Where you're at, do you think they're going to do Death of Elektra? Do you feel like it's at all...
Oh, I think they... I think they have to. But she's already died twice.
Oh. You know?
I don't think it's going to have quite the same effect at this point if they want to do the storyline.
Like she dies.
Read.
Yeah, she dies in. I mean, spoiler, but she dies. She dies at the end of Season 2 of Daredevil, and she's brought back, and she's kind of the villain in the Defenders, or one of the villains. Defenders was just not good. It's disappointing. and I couldn't even finish it. And Jessica Jones Season 2 also, I just kind of but. I think that if they do it the right way, that this would be a good Bullseye. They could do the Bullseye issue that we read, note for note, and nail it, and it would be so amazing. Because I don't know, they do they the stuff they're doing with Bullseye is really, really cool. And they're fleshing out the characters even more. We learn more about Foggy. We learn more about Karen. We learn more about Matt, you know, and his family and everything. And so cannot recommend season 3 of Daredevil highly enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Marvel Netflix shows, I kind of struggle with them because I have a similar reaction to them that I do to Marvel Zombies, where they kind of gross me out sometimes.
Oh.
Especially, I'm thinking about Jessica Jones and guys like running people through food processors and all sorts of nasty stuff.
Yeah,
but
that's horrifying. Yeah.
But like, if there's one thing that keeps me coming back, it's the character work that they do. And in particular, I don't think any character in the Marvel Netflix shows, or even in overall the Marvel movies, I don't think there's a single character who has had as much good work done with them as Wilson Fisk.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's just like, he's awesome in this. And just, you know, schemes upon schemes upon schemes. And just, it's awesome to see, you know, him making things work from behind bars and then not so much behind bars. I don't know. And great, great fight scenes too.
Yeah. Freaking so. Vincent D'Onofrio just steals the scene. And then Daredevil always did have the best action of those Marvel friends. Except for the Luke Cage hallway fight scene, is still my favorite, actually.
I forget how that one went down.
Oh, he's just, like, walking through the hall and people are, like, punching him. And he's just like, ugh. And he just slams him into the wall and keep
Luke
walking.
Luke Cage also, I think, had one of the best soundtracks. But that's...
Definitely.
Oh, definitely. Biased. Definitely. I just wish that, like, because everyone involved was talented, but then they were given, like, crap dialogue, and the plot didn't make any sense to me. It was just,
oh, and Diamondback was just not anywhere near the caliber of villain that show needed.
Yeah.
I think Cottonmouth was the one they had in the first half, and Cottonmouth was pretty good, I thought. Diamondback just, I just wasn't feeling it.
But, you know, actually the funny thing is, so we keep talking about the Kingpin, and that's actually just making me anxious, because the Spider-Man DLC dropped today.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh. And, like, it's just another excuse for me to, like, dive back into New York. And I'm just like, ooh, I didn't think about that at all during the podcast. And now y'all brought that up.
Well, I think that's going to wrap us up for this week. Aldo, John, I hope you both have a happy Halloween. Don't punch out any Silver Surfers.
Or eat them.
Or eat them. Or do eat them. That gives you superpowers. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Superhuman Registration Podcast. We hope that you'll be with us in 2 weeks when we read 1602 and The House of M. Thank you once again, and watch out, because you are on our list. And if you would like to unsubscribe from our list, you may do so by contacting the Federal Do Not Call Registry at 1-888-382-1222.
Is that accurate?
Yes, it is.